Documentary on News Talk.
Now on Documentary and Drama on News Talk, producer Orla Reardon looks at the significant increase in eating disorders, body dysmorphia and illegal steroid use amongst young Irish men. A warning that sensitive topics and upsetting content are discussed in this documentary, including eating disorders, suicide and suicidal ideation. This is Dying to Get Ripped.
There's no point denying I have one of, I suppose, the best physiques in the country, if not Europe, on a bodybuilding level. But because I'm always chasing a better me, I'll never see myself as perfection. I'll never see myself as the finished product.
In the last episode of Dying to Get Ripped, we spoke about the difficulties facing young men who have an eating disorder, disordered eating, and body dysmorphia. In episode 2, we will explore the risk factors that are unique to men, such as overexercise, steroid abuse, and an over-reliance on dietary supplements.
It's not because it's you, it can affect anybody and everybody. And to give some hope that you can get better from it.
Love Island is a dating reality TV show that originated in the UK in 2005. It features a group of contestants who live together in a specially constructed villa in Mallorca in an attempt to find love. The islanders couple up with each other based on first impressions, but over the duration of the series, they have to recouple where they can choose to remain with their current partner or swap partners. Any of the islanders who remain single after the recoupling takes place is eliminated and dumped from the island. Islanders can also be eliminated via public vote. The show has been hugely successful and became ITV's most watched show in the network's history in 2018. As of 2020, it was the most watched TV show amongst its target audience of 16 to 34 year olds. Claire Mann Cormac Murphy was introduced as a bombshell on season 1 of Love Island USA, which aired on CBS in 2019. He explains how he ended up on the show.
My generation came up watching reality shows, Jersey Shore, Geordie Shore, so it was very image focused, what you're wearing, everything like that. It was very vain, you know, like we grew up watching those shows, but we got into the more gym side of things, so it was very visual, how you look, how you feel. You know, I decided to make the move over to New York. I was telling people at the time, it's because I wanted to be a model, but I was going over because I knew the party scene was quite big there as well. And obviously my story kind of has addiction in there as well. But, you know, I knew New York was where male models went to kind of pursue their career. So that's how it really kind of started, you know. This show wasn't going ahead, so the casting director had something else in line, and that ended up being Love Island USA season 1. But I was originally approached to do the UK one, and the producers had obviously seen that I was living in New York, so it worked better for me to do the USA one rather than the UK one. I knew of the show. I had seen people go on there before that I'd kind of brushed shoulders with in the nightclubs in New York, but I really didn't know what it was about, and that was probably my downfall. I didn't really prep. The only preparation I did before going in the show was my training. That was it. Obviously, I knew I was going to be on TV, so I wanted to get in the best shape of my life, you know, physically, but I didn't really prepare mentally or emotionally. But looking back at it now, I have a lot more perspective on it. I was very immature going into the villa. I thought it was just, you got to look good and that's it, but there's actually a lot more to that.
Cormac was struggling with addiction issues at the time of his appearance on the reality show. He had been building his online profile steadily in the US and felt that landing a spot as a bombshell on Love Island would be his big break. It turned out to be one of the darkest times of his life when he was dumped from the island after 8 days.
Oh, a lot happened when I came out. I was only in the villa for probably 8 or 9 nights. The Love Island USA season 1 was actually only a 4-week show. Really went into that phase of my life with the drink and the drugs, and you know, I fell into addiction, and it was really bad. It was bad before the show, but I was training so hard to prepare for Love Island. I always had distractions, whether it was shoots or trying to get time with agencies, and obviously Love Island. So there was always something pulling me back. It was always a push pull with my drinking and drugging. But I saw myself on TV and wasn't really happy with who I saw. You know, I was struggling mentally. And I really, really dove into the alcohol and drugs after Love Island.
Cormac was battling an addiction to cocaine, alcohol and other substances and maintains he wasn't mentally prepared to go on the TV show.
Yeah, everything, physically, mentally, emotionally. I was definitely emotionally not ready for something like that. I think people think, you know, you just have to look good to be on a show, but really you have to be mentally strong and emotionally prepared because it's a dating show. You know, they expect a lot out of you to go on a show. That's why they pick you in the first place. You have to go through a lot of evaluations, psych tests and stuff like that to make sure that they know that you're ready to be on the show. But I didn't really prepare anything before there. You know, I was just still doing my thing in nightclubs. I was working out 5-6 times a week. I was eating well, but I was still partying even in preparation. I stopped doing drugs, but I was still drinking a couple of times a week. But mentally, I just wasn't ready to go on a show as big as Love Island. You know, I had seen clips on YouTube channels of Love Island, and every guy was in shape. Every guy was tan, their teeth, their hair, everything was perfect. So I definitely had that in mind, you know, but there was so much more to that as well. I thought it was just how you looked, and I thought that was going to appeal to everyone on the show. And it, lo and behold, it really didn't, because I was only coupled up with one girl in there. But I remember I had, at the time, this was my thinking. I remember I was like, oh, they're all going to love me. But in fact, that wasn't the case. You know, there was a load of other guys who had a lot more to offer rather than just how they looked, you know.
Although physically, Cormac had exactly what it took to get onto a show like Love Island, his mental health was not in a good place at the time. Following his exit from the show, his drug and alcohol addiction became even more pronounced. He attempted to take his own life at his lowest point. Following a stint in rehab in 2020 back at home in his native Clare, he embraced his sobriety and decided to use his own life experience to help other young men who might be struggling with their own body image issues. Although there is no comprehensive study to say that the media hype surrounding programs like these and the images shown on screen can cause eating disorders, young men can get drawn into negative self-evaluation.
Did I compare myself to the other guys on there? Absolutely. You know, I was training very hard, yet I was still comparing my physique to others. You know, I was like, oh my God, he's bigger than me. He's more ripped than me. Like, you know, and I'm busting my ass off here. And I'm not up to what I thought the standard was, because I trained a lot before that. And then I went into a hotel room for 2 weeks prior to the show, and I wasn't moving as much. I wasn't training as much. So I felt like my results weren't as good when I got to Fiji in comparison to when I actually went into the villa. I can't even imagine what it would be like being an 18-year-old kid on social media and you're seeing all these older guys. It has its pros and cons. Social media now, everything is a sell. You know, people are selling you this, selling you that. I was guilty of that as well. I've been guilty of, you know, pushing products, being paid for certain things back in the day, but my core values now were different.
Love Island producers were offered the right to reply, and they sent me their duty of care policies, which they have implemented over the past few years. Cormac does not shy away from sharing details of his past with his followers on social media. He has over 150,000 followers on Instagram and TikTok, and says when he started talking about his addiction struggles online, it touched a lot of people, particularly young men. Cormac was crowned Mr. USA in September 2024 and was runner-up in the Mr. Universe competition, losing to another Irishman, Patrick Callaghan. His message to young men is that these reality TV shows are not always realistic. It's not real life. Real people have flaws and no one is perfect.
I always recommend to stay active, right? But there's a lot more things than looking at your best, right? You know what I mean? Like I'll be going golfing, I'll be going for swims, I'll be going for hikes. Like there's a lot more ways to be healthy than judging yourself by how you look in the mirror. That's what I would say, you know? And everyone grows differently, you know, especially with men. You might have some friends who are genetically just bigger than you, stronger than you, and that's okay, you know? I always recommend just try and stay in your own lane, like, you know, try and focus on yourself, building your strength up, not just physically, but mentally and emotionally as well.
ITV introduced its first comprehensive Love Island duty of care policy in May 2019, with updated protocols implemented ahead of the show's fifth series. Guidelines and welfare reflected former Islanders' feedback and included comprehensive psychological and medical support for all Islanders by an independent doctor before, during and after filming. For many young men, societal pressures, including media portrayals of muscularity and the idealised male physique, contribute to a distorted perception of one's body image. Social media, fitness culture, and advertisements frequently amplify unrealistic body standards, leading some young men to engage in extreme measures such as excessive exercise or unhealthy dietary practices in an attempt to perfect their appearance. This can have serious repercussions on mental health, leading to anxiety, depression, and a reduced quality of life. Bodybuilding is associated with the ultimate pursuit of the body beautiful. Niall Kennefic is a champion bodybuilder and owner of Conquer HQ Fitness in Youghal. He explains how he got into the extraordinary world of competitive bodybuilding.
The training aspect of things as a personal trainer definitely came first. Because when I got into the gym, without some arrogance, like, it was actually about looking good in a tight t-shirt. I didn't care about how anyone else looked. I just wanted to go on a Saturday night and look good. Bodybuilding kind of started to kind of slightly grow over in Ireland around then. Then I just kind of said to myself, okay, because I wanted to challenge myself outside just going to the gym, I actually started off doing a fitness photo shoot. I think I was actually one of the first people in the country to do it. So as a competitor, in 2015, I won a national title at under 75s. So basically the best under 75 kg bodybuilder in the country. A week later then, I was first person to do this, went on and won Mr. Cork at under 80. So I actually stepped up weight category. And then last year, I went on to win national title under 80s and Mr. Ireland PCA Classic.
Muscle dysmorphia is a disorder characterized by a preoccupation with a perceived defect in one's physique, and it can lead to multiple problems. Competing in the bodybuilding world requires an intense commitment bordering on the obsessive. Niall explains the extent of his commitment.
I think to be successful in bodybuilding, again, genetics being a big part of it, but your mindset is the thing that dictates the outcome all day. You can have all the physical attributes in the world. You can look like the best bodybuilder in the world. You could have everything going for you, but if you don't have the mindset to lock in when necessary, again, to switch it on, you're not going to get anywhere with it. My last showing was the November 5th and PCAs. The next day, my shows were picked for next year. I started the next day. That was it. Had a day off at Emma, enjoyed a bit of food, and had it locked in for next year. But again, like, there's levels to it. I wouldn't say everyone needs to go through that extreme. I'm kind of at the stage of my bodybuilding career, like, how many years do I have left? So can my body, and my mind, can my body keep doing this? So realistically, if I'm looking to compete in this year, it'll be October, November. But realistically, what I'm doing now is going to dictate my success to when I start my actual prep. It's basically just like having three switches, one being off season, the middle one being before prep, and then the top part of it just being prep.
There have been several American studies on this, which have shown that since bodybuilding is literally about appearance, male bodybuilders are particularly vulnerable to eating disorders and body image dissatisfaction as a consequence of the obsession to be more muscular and leaner.
It goes from normal to extreme very quick. Training-wise, weights, it'd be 5 days a week. I wouldn't go past that. My body's not going to recover. It's funny saying, anyone can think this way, anyone can act this way. You can't, like, you'll see the person who wins the shows, they stand out because they look like a trophy. They look like a Greek god. Like, literally, one of the trophies we get is a Greek god. Like, that's the image we're based off. But then you'll see people who are, like, maybe third, fourth, fifth, and they're nowhere near that level of condition because, again, the mindset that they're not able to pull themselves, they're thinking, like, we have the kind of saying, you're going to a dark hole. You basically stand in a dark corner for 12, 16, 20 weeks. And I relish being in that position. It's just, you have to get excited about it. But just knowing you can do it is what gets me going. It's kind of knowing I can just say one day I wake up, yeah, I'm good to go. Like, for me, when I look at myself personally, there's no point denying I have one of, I suppose, the best physiques in the country, if not Europe, on a bodybuilding level. And because I'm always chasing a better me, I'll never see myself as perfection. I'll never see myself as the finished product, because I think the day I do that is the day I'll stop. Because with bodybuilding, it's all about progression.
The desire for a perfectly sculpted body can lead to some men pushing themselves to their limits and still not attaining the body they desire. This can lead to the use of performance-enhancing substances, or PEDs, as they are more commonly known. Anabolic steroids can take the form of tablet, capsules, or injectable liquids, known as roids, gear, or being on the juice. There are several different bodybuilding federations in Ireland and across the world. the different associations have different stances on the use of PEDs. It really is a grey area, and there is a difference between a competition that is steroids-free and one that is not testing for steroids. Niall gave us his take on the issue.
So when I started competing, there was no natural federations. It was non-tested, and then about maybe 4 or 5 years ago, it kind of came about where testing federation is coming in. What's definitely coming to light a lot more is just the educational factor. It's growing, and it's going to continue to grow and grow and grow, hopefully to the point where that 18, 19-year-old who shouldn't be taking anything in the first place actually is being educated on what they're actually doing. I suppose outside the bodybuilding world, people don't actually know how bad the drugs are. Like, you can research all you want, but unless you actually sit down with a bodybuilder who's at a high level, you actually have no idea what is going to some people's body. It's frightening. Like, from a personal level, you're not gaining anything. Professional level, you're literally actually taken away of anything, if you ask me. Like,
in the pursuit for perfection, the lines between personal aspiration and societal expectations can often blur. Millions of young men follow fitness influencers on social media, and it can be difficult to distinguish between a healthy passion for fitness and a dangerous fixation on physical ideals.
First thing is, there's no such thing as perfection. You are who you are. Like, I just think the problem today isn't with young fellas looking at themselves, it's looking at everyone else. Like, an obsessor, like, say, fitness influencers. And I know I have young fellas that do the same thing to me, but, like, I think from a coaching standpoint, I know what to kind of approach things properly when it comes to that. I think just they're too busy looking at someone else's lifestyle saying, he looks that way because he does X, Y, Z. If I do X, Y, Z, I'm going to look like that way, rather than actually just focus on themselves. From someone who started this at a young age, I know for a fact the only reason I'm still doing it is because I only focus on my journey, rather than actually chasing someone else's. I just chase the better me. Like, I'm an insecure individual at certain points. Like, there's no point denying it. Like, you're going to be insecure about something. Like you're never going to look at yourself, like I said a while ago, and see something perfect. So, I mean, that's never going to exist. Like, yeah, you can chase perfection, but that's just going to keep you, obviously help you improve, getting better and better. At the end of the day, we're all human. We all are going to have our hangups. We're all going to have insecurities. We're all going to go through phases where we don't feel sexy, or we don't feel like the biggest guy in the room. It's perfectly normal. My thing is to embrace it. We're not actually looking at it as a weakness. It's that thing that's going to get you that next level. Learn how to use those insecurities as, I suppose, a tool to work towards a better you. Like,
the Health Products Regulatory Authority detained close to 900,000 units of illegal medicines in 2023. Over 250,000 of the illegal substances detained were anabolic steroids. 250,922 units, to be exact. This figure reflects a massive increase over the past decade or so in the detection of illegal steroids entering the country. It's gone from 3% in 2011 to 30% in 2023. Gráinne Power is the Director of Compliance with the HPRA and explains the process for detecting these illegal substances.
Very often, and actually more regularly as the years roll on, is we find shipments of anabolic steroids being imported into the country. And so our relationship with Customs and the HPRA as part of disrupting that illegal supply is very much, you know, our day-to-day operations. And then the guards, as part of their management of the illicit supply chain for controlled substances, etc., we will also interact with them, because often there's a mix of activities in all of these things. It's partly revenue, partly HPRA, partly the guards. So as I say, day on day, we work together to protect the public and to disrupt the supply of these products. What we know is that the quantity of anabolic steroids that are entering the country through these supply chains and the size of those detentions is increasing, you know, year on year. So it's big business out there for somebody. It's really unsafe product. Yes, somebody can possibly unwittingly be offered it in a gym and be told that it's okay, or somebody is expert enough to manage its administration or its, you know, somebody's regime. But ultimately, these are serious prescription medicines. They are used in classic medical practice, or legitimately in medical practice, in really specialist on really specialist occasions in very rare circumstances. They are not used for performance enhancements or, you know, increased athleticism. They have a serious pharmacological impact on your body. You will have adverse effects when you take them. But not only that, you will have adverse effects after. And, you know, sometimes irreparable damage can be done to your body as a result of taking them.
Coming up after the break, Grainne explains how the internet plays a significant role in flooding the Irish market with illegal steroids and how the HPRA, Customs and the Gardaí are working to stop this.
You're listening to Dying to Get Ripped on Documentary and Drama on News Talk. This is Documentary and Drama on News Talk. You're listening to Dying to Get Ripped. A reminder that sensitive topics and upsetting content feature in this documentary.
Despite the potential risks of taking illegal steroids, many Irish men are willing to take the risk and overlook the long-term effects on their well-being. Using them at a young age can have serious health consequences, including hormonal imbalances, liver damage, erectile dysfunction, infertility, as well as mental health issues, aggression, and mood swings. Merchants Quay Ireland, which runs one of the largest needle exchange operations in the country, have noted that over the past few years, young men between the ages of 18 and 35 are coming to use the service for needles and other equipment to inject steroids. This group would not see themselves as typical drug users at all. The ease of buying steroids online have been cited as one of the reasons for the upward trend in the importation of these drugs.
We can see a change in the way illicit medicines are promoted online. We have a focus on cybercrime and monitoring the internet. And we can even see changes in the last number of years on how people promote what are kind of lifestyle medicines. You know, it can be anabolic steroids, it can be melanotan, it can be your Botox. So there's probably a different level of sophistication to some of this, you know, like any enforcement policing unit, there's an investigation side, but there's also an intelligence side. You have to be looking around and looking at the horizon and seeing what's coming. And a lot of what we do, or is more and more a significant part of what we do, is we monitor online activity. And we seek to disrupt that, you know, and we are involved in taking, you know, working with social media companies to take down websites, to block websites so that it's difficult for people to access these products. But you know, what we see is an increasing level of sophistication in the marketing of substances that have, you know, do they have a chemical impact or a pharmacological impact on your body? Absolutely. Is there any data to back them up? No, there isn't. And are they coming from a legitimate, well-controlled supply chain? Like, you know, the tableting and pharmaceutical plants we have all around the country? Absolutely not. You might think what you're getting is what the guy in the gym has told you. You've no idea what's in that vial. You've no idea what's in that injection. And you're putting it into your body.
A previous report by the HPRA showed that 1 in 5 of those aged 18 to 34 would consider taking steroids, but nearly half of those surveyed were unaware or not sure of the side effects of steroid use. The legal repercussions are also worth noting. As anabolic steroids should only be prescribed by a doctor, it is illegal to sell them or supply them. This includes giving them to friends. The penalties range from a fine up to €2,000 or a jail sentence. Grainne explains more about how the HPRA are trying to get the seriousness of this issue into the public consciousness.
Part of the reason for speaking to you today is to communicate the serious nature of these medicines, and not necessarily to communicate to somebody who's actively taking them today and may not be persuaded by you or by me, But to talk to the family members, the friends of people who are engaging in this, and because research shows that people are influenced by the views of their families and friends, these medicines in the long term can cause organ failure, they can cause stroke, they can do irreparable damage. It's not about stopping it and the risk goes away. You've done the damage within your body. So it may be that people don't see the extent of how bad it can be. It's also, again, from some research done recently, I came across in America, was it's in that age group that you talk about, that sort of 18 to 35 age group, is the age group that's seen as particularly active in using these kind of medicines. And it's probably a time in your life when body image is really important. Probably not a surprise that it possibly more normalized in that cohort as well, as not understanding the full extent of the risks. But I think the more conversation we can have about this, the more sort of open communication, not in a blaming kind of way, but in a general public health perspective, the more the public health system can work to get these messages out there. I think it can only help the situation.
The message seems to be clear. Once you step outside the regulated supply chain, you have absolutely no guarantees as to the safety, quality, or effectiveness of these substances. Young men are putting their health and their lives at risk. They are literally dying to get ripped. The Irish Rugby Football Union is the governing body that represents the whole island of Ireland in rugby union. The four provinces, Munster, Leinster, Ulster and Connacht, all come under the IRFU remit. The success of the Irish men's national team over the past few years has seen the sport's popularity rise. Young men and women across the country are looking to our top rugby players as role models with regard to fitness, sporting ability and resilience. This is something the IRFU takes very seriously. Emma Gardner is the head nutritionist for the men's national team. We began by speaking about the changes in the importance of proper nutrition for rugby players over the past few years.
It's changed for a number of reasons. I think our understanding of the research has changed. I would say accessibility has changed, and I would say our resource has changed. So in terms of, I suppose, the world of social media, the accessibility to nutrition information has also grown, and that can be positive and negative for us as practitioners, because of course, like anything, some of that information will be very good and it will be sound, whereas some of it will potentially be challenging in terms of, do we agree with that? Is there genuine evidence behind that? And that can become difficult for any person, let alone younger athletes in particular, who are trying to start out in their careers. But I suppose where we're fortunate within the IRFU is we have a very saturated system in terms of nutrition support. So we have 12 nutritionists within our team. The access for our players to support has obviously drastically increased in the 10 years, and it's hugely important for them. And we're very fortunate that we work in multidisciplinary teams where our practitioners also understand that as well and will help to ensure that we align with our work.
It is safe to say that rugby had previously been perceived as being a macho sport where no vulnerabilities could be discussed. However, over the past 10 years, more and more male rugby players are being open and honest about discussing issues such as mental health, physical health, sexuality and eating disorders. This is incredibly useful to young men who may be going through the same thing and who see these players as role models. Players like Ireland and Leinster prop Andrew Porter have begun to destigmatise male eating disorders, as Andrew was very open on how he developed anorexia following the death of his beloved mum from breast cancer. The Tackle Your Feelings campaign for schools in 2023 encouraged any young person who may be suffering from anxiety or stress to reach out and ask for help. I was interested to know if the IRFU had any policies in place to help with anyone who may be struggling with disordered eating behaviours.
We almost start before we identify it with our culture. So we very much encourage open discussions as an organisation within this space, and we aim to educate both players and staff. So rather than waiting for something to happen, be proactive. And I think that's something, well, that's changed again in the last 10 years, because probably historically there wasn't the expertise in place and there wasn't the education in place. And therefore, sadly, it often waited till, you know, it struck. And then we were obviously being reactive to that. So it starts with our culture of being proactive. But we're very fortunate then if we filter, we then have expertise and a multidisciplinary team around us. So we know that disordered eating and eating disorders, it's complex and it's a spectrum, and athletes and individuals can sit on that spectrum at varying levels of severity. But we also know it's a cognitive disorder. So it would be remiss of me to not have a psychologist representative within this discussion if we were talking in the detail of what our policies are, but also medical. And we're fortunate within the IRFU that we've got multiple expertise across the pathways and across our senior systems. So if we do have any cases, we can then identify them and treat them accordingly. So through our culture, through our screening processes, through our expertise and through referral and treatment, if we need to, we do have hopefully a robust policy. But that's, of course, ever changing. And the more we understand, the more we research, we obviously have to be fluid with that and we have to adjust as and when is necessary.
Researchers in the Youth Mental Health Lab in UCD have found that the secretive nature of male eating disorders, combined with overuse of supplements, overexercising, and steroid abuse, have left men showing low levels of help-seeking tendencies. Irish men are putting themselves at risk by taking unregulated products, whether these are supplements that are not batch-tested or illegal steroids. Dietary supplements are also called food or nutritional supplements and are regulated by the Food Safety Authority in Ireland. Research surrounding supplements available off the shelves in Ireland or online from anywhere in the world remains a grey area. There are many different research papers on what supplements do or do not contain and the risk of unintended doping because of it. The advice is, do your research before putting any supplement into your body, or better still, talk to a professional.
Crouch! Give him some space to come down. He's a bit taller than you, so let him come in. You're tall enough, but not as tall as him.
Nigel Owens is a Welsh former international rugby union referee who retired in December 2020 after a 17-year career. He is widely considered to be one of the greatest rugby referees of all time. His no-nonsense attitude and humour on the pitch is legendary.
The law is quite clear. Maul is formed, held up, unplayable, turnover ball, no issues whatsoever. I don't think we've met before. But I'm the referee on this field, not you. Stick to your job and I will do mine. If I hear you shouting for anything again, I'm going to be penalising you. This is not soccer. Is that clear? Back you go and get on with the game.
Nigel also has bulimia. I sat down with him on a recent visit to Belfast to discuss how this disease has affected his life and how he copes with it today. He began by telling me what triggered his eating disorder back when he was 18 years of age.
The image that I was seeing myself in the mirror was not an image that I wanted or liked. Probably a lot to do with at the time was discovering my sexuality as well, probably contributing to that. So that's where it all started. And then it became quite frequent then, sort of from the sort of 19 years of age on until I was about 35, probably not every day, but pretty most days. Probably if I was feeling, because I used to suffer from mental health issues during that period, dealing with my sexuality. And then that would trigger you to maybe spend a lot of time on your own, you'd drink a lot, comfort eat a lot and everything as well. During that early part of it, it was a case of, well, you know, I can eat this and it's not a problem, I can bring it all back up. So instead of having the willpower, I guess, it was an easy way out in one sense. And for a long time, probably the best part of maybe 7-8 years, I just didn't know much about it or realise the damage that I was doing.
The stigma and shame associated with mental health issues are often magnified when coupled with an eating disorder. Although highly successful as a referee on the pitch, off the pitch, Nigel struggled with fluctuating weight and his bulimia became worse before Six Nations or World Cup games. He felt he was under pressure to be fit and would eat and purge regularly.
Yeah, 2012-13, from 13, leading up to the World Cup in 2015, where I was coming up to 44 years of age at the time, and you had to pass a fitness test to go to the World Cup. And the fitness test for a guy at 44 was the same fitness test for a guy who was 22. And they weren't taking that into account, which is something that I sort of, you know, brought up with them at the time. I was fit enough to referee, there was no doubt about that, but there were a fitness test to pass. I mean, a couple of the older referees, you know, we were really sort of struggling to reach that. I was training hard and I thought, right, I know how I can lose these kilos easily, and I just started making myself ill again. So I didn't have to give up the eating and the food. I would, you know, make myself ill, and I lost those kilos, passed the fitness test, and then went on to referee the World Cup final. But it was a continuous battle then, pretty much still every day then, from 2013 all the way through till about 2020, 21.
Nigel also freely admits using steroids to bulk up during this time in his life.
During that sort of very stressful period from dealing with my sexuality, I wanted to believe it was probably at its peak. During that time, when I also was, I was taking steroids and stuff as well, and the mental health issues and the dark place I was in at the time, they do you harm. There's a reason. It's only prescribed to you. There's a reason, because there are side effects to it. But it gave me that confidence, I guess, and I, you know, gave me a body that I felt confident in, and other people were telling you, you're looking good, you know, you put some weight on, you look as good shape on you. So it gave you that confidence as well. And during the early part of that period, take the steroids and then you'd come off it. But then after the first couple of years, then I couldn't come off it. So when I was abusing the steroids, so I was taking the steroids and continuing, so I wasn't coming off it at all. Whereas at the early stage, when I was taking it, coming off it, you weren't really seeing any side effects or not feeling any side effects because you were going on it and coming off it. But then it just got hold of you then, and you were abusing it. But obviously then, you know, there were side effects then, especially when I was on it and not coming off it at all. And then I had 3 operations, I think, to remove sort of growth on my breasts, which are side effects from the steroids. After the shower or bath, you could see, you know, a bit of loss of hair coming along as well. So there were side effects to it. I become very sort of short-tempered and stuff as well. Yeah, I would, every day was a constant challenge of living this lie, dealing with this fear of being found out. You know, every day was, you were feeling, you know, oh God, the weight of the world on your shoulders. But then when I was on the rugby pitch, that never showed, because I was now, it was my escape, I guess. You know, although the week would have been horrendous up and down mentally and everything, between the bulimia and the mental health issues as well, the week would have been horrendous, you know. But actually then on that field for 80 minutes, I was on my stage, I suppose. So on the field, I was safe for 80 minutes, I suppose, on the field. Then off the field, the bulimia, the steroids, the mental health issues, being impatient, you know, being depressed, all that then was a constant day in, day out, living with it. You become very good at hiding it, I guess. I'm very good at lying as well. And I suppose with the bulimia as well, until it gets to a stage where you can't hide it anymore. But I think that is the danger, I think, with the eating disorder, particularly like bulimia as well, is a lot of that damage is done when you can hide it, when nobody knows. It only, when it probably gets to the stage where people know there's something wrong, a lot of the damage is done.
In April 1996, at 3:30 in the morning, Nigel Owens left his parents' house with the express intent of taking his own life. At this point, he was 25 years old and had bulimia for many years. He had become hooked on steroids and was obsessively training at his local gym. His parents found the note he had left, and a search party mobilised immediately. A police helicopter spotted him unconscious, and he was airlifted to hospital. Subsequently, Nigel found out that he would have died had the crew taken just 30 minutes longer to find him. Nigel came out as a gay man in May 2007.
When you're in that dark place, and whatever that dark place is, whether it's, you know, worries or mental health issues or eating disorders, you seem to think that you're a burden to other people, you know, but you're not. You know, that the people that love you will want to help you, and they don't want to live your life. And that's why a lot of people would take their own lives. They'd actually believe that, you know, well, the people that matter to me more than anybody in the world are actually going to be better off without me in it. Well, it's the complete opposite. Now, I was lucky. I got within another 30 minutes and I wouldn't be here today. But I got the second chance. And when I got the second chance, I then saw and realized it was the complete opposite of what I was thinking. But unfortunately, not everybody gets that second chance. And self-acceptance is important as well, I think, because unless you can accept I am struggling, then you're not gonna take that next step of dealing with it or asking for help. That, I think, helps as well, is in knowing that you're not alone. And I think what does help in the self-acceptance are other people sharing those stories or raising the awareness around. Because all of a sudden, oh God, it's just not me.
And that'll give you a little bit of hope and a little bit of encouragement and hopefully a little bit of strength, because it is strength. When you actually open up and say, look, I'm suffering from an eating disorder here, or I'm struggling here, I need help. Oh, that's a great strength. It's not a weakness. But a self-acceptance is important. And I think raising awareness will help a lot with that self-acceptance, I think, and knowing that it's just not you.
Nigel says his bulimia is always with him, but he has managed to keep it under control for over 2 years now. He would like to see eating disorders, particularly in males, treated with the same seriousness as other life-threatening diseases.
Yeah, I think men in particular, are getting better at talking, I think. And it's hard in one sense, but it's good in another sense that there are foundations and organisations there, you know, that people can ring up and talk and seek help. They will tell you there's a huge amount of people getting in touch, which is sound. People are asking for help, which is a good thing, but still there's a long, long, long way to go on. And I think it is the pressures today on people, you know, pressure of job security, you know, the pressures of living today's society, where there's huge pressure on you and, you know, people worrying about being able to afford to put food on the table. So all this is contributing on that image as well, you know, that image of, you know, I've got to look like that in order to be on telly or to get a beautiful wife or a beautiful husband. I need to look like that. It is very similar, I believe, to life-threatening diseases like cancer, for example, because if you can find out that you've got cancer in the early stages, there's a good chance that you can survive and get better from it. Or the worst case scenario is, you know, you can at least have medication and live a reasonable life with living with it. And I think mental health issues and bulimia and stuff is no different. You know, if you can identify and deal with it early on, then there's a good chance that you can get better from it. And people, you can get better from it. That to me is the important thing about it. You can get better from it. But obviously the longer that you let it go, then recovery becomes a longer process and a more difficult process then. And that's why I think it's important in raising awareness and getting people to talk about their own experiences and to give people hope, I guess, you know, to hope that it's not because it's you, it can affect anybody and everybody. And to give some hope that you can get better from it.
Over the course of this documentary, we've learned that eating disorders can affect anyone, regardless of gender, age, race, sexuality, or socioeconomic status. It is a common misconception that only women have eating disorders. And we know from experts in the field that this stereotype has added to men's shame and reluctance to seek help before they reach crisis point. Men have to face a double stigma: the fact that they have an eating disorder and the fact that they are a man. Over the past 10 years, the figures have risen from 1 in 10 men presenting with an eating disorder to 1 in 4. Steroid use amongst young men is increasing at a worrying rate. A 2023 report from the Health Products Regulatory Authority showed the detection of these illegal products has risen from 3% in 2019 to 30% in 2023. The issue isn't going away, and young men are putting their health, fertility, and their lives at risk by taking steroids, either by injection or in tablet form, that they have no way of knowing exactly what's in them. Body dysmorphia or bigorexia is adding to the stress young men are under as they search for what is perceived to be the perfect body in order to have the perfect life. Social media has only added to the ever-growing obsession with perfection, but at what cost? The HSE reports that eating disorders have the highest mortality rate of all mental health issues, with 20% of those suffering dying by suicide or health complications. As of March 2024, there are only 3 adult eating disorder beds available for the whole country, and they are located in St. Vincent's Hospital in Dublin. The purpose of this documentary is to highlight this growing issue so that everyone, regardless of gender, can get the proper help and support that they need. If you have been affected by any of the topics discussed in this documentary, you can contact the Bodywise helpline on 01 210 7906 or the Samaritans on 116 123. This programme was funded by Cumasú na mBan with the television licence fee. Written and presented by Orla Reardon, edited by Sean Healy and Steve Downing. Music by Steve Downing.